Your aunt and I are two very perceptive people. We know what you did at the church. I can't wait to tell your father all I know about you.
What the hell do you know? Everything's happening so fast. Dom said whoever did it frightened her half to death.
Where was she?
She was in the basement. What's the matter, Fatty?
Hello?
Oh, Dom?
Who is this?
Angela!
Fat, you give it to that horn!
Hi, this is Lori Lafine, and we're on Hysteria Continues.
And indeed you are. Welcome to the Hysteria Continues, episode 141. And this time we are going back to 1960s. And it's not the Shangri-Las, it's the, well, what the kind of the Murderinos. We're going to be going back to some Catholic terror in the 1960s, of Holy Terror or Alice Sweet Alice. We're joined by a very special guest, Bill Ackerman from the Supporting Characters podcast, who very kindly donated to Nathan and Joseph's fundraiser for Gory Graduation. And this is your listener pick, Bill. So very pleased to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm a longtime fan, so it's exciting for me.
No, it's brilliant. And I say I did an interview with you, Bill, didn't I, for one of your earlier episodes of Supporting Characters. I can't remember which episode it was, but yeah, that was a lot of fun. So it's really good to reconnect with you on the show.
I had Amanda Reyes on not too long ago as well for listeners of your show that might know her as well.
Mm. I think they are familiar, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Would you like just a brief mention, actually, what your podcast is about, basically, in case people would like to check it out, which I say to people they should check it out. It's very, very good.
Yeah. So the idea behind the show is to talk to people that have turned their interest in film into some kind of project or vocation, whether it be fanzines or podcasts or film writers, authors. And I've had a few people that deal with horror subject matter, such as yourself. And I just did an episode with Lee Gambin, who I think is doing the liner notes for The Slayer that you guys did the commentary for, the Arrow release.
Cool. Yeah.
It's people that took their love of film into some other direction than filmmaking itself, but that, turned that love of movies into some kind of project that they share with others.
Excellent.
So that's the show.
Yeah, so do check it out. I'm sure you can find it in all the normal places.
Yeah. It's on iTunes and all that.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Bill. And we'll be talking about your choice in a little while, but just see how everyone else is doing. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing very good. I'm fresh off guesting on another podcast last night.
Oh, were you?
Being a podcast whore. I was cheating with Gore Blimey on the Trilogy of Terror podcast. Now, it's not going to be out for a good few weeks because he has two episodes in the bag that he needs to publish. He's first up going to be doing a Trilogy of Terror look at three films by Steve Miner. And then I was talking to him last night about the first four Friday the 13th movies. So that'll be coming out maybe in July, I would say, at this stage. So look forward to that.
Okay, excellent. I think I'm going to be doing that as well at some point.
Excellent, yeah.
I'm sure we can get Joseph and Nathan on talking about your favourite trilogies. Maybe Crazy Fat Airful 3? Is there such a thing?
There's no 3, though.
Well, we discussed 4 Friday the 13th, so I think we bent the rules a bit slightly last night.
Yeah, so, okay, cool.
We did mention Crazy Fat Ethel too, though.
Did you?
Yes, well, I can't remember what context it came up, but yeah.
It had to have been like it's a great film.
Yeah. Well, where's the tumbleweed sound effect? But anyway, Nathan, how are you doing?
I'm doing very good. The podcast that I cheat on you guys with, we just released a new episode, which covers made-for-TV slashers, Five Desperate Women and She's Dressed to Kill.
Excellent.
And who is the main host on that podcast, pray tell?
Amanda Reyes.
Oh.
I don't know anyone that knows more about TV films than she does.
She is the queen of the TV movie. I haven't seen either of those films, but I would like to, because we've got a nice new big TV. We can run YouTube through it, and I imagine both of those are probably on YouTube, although I might be wrong.
Five Desperate Women is. She's Dressed to Kill. It may be on YouTube, but that's not where I watched it, so I'm not sure about that one.
I had to watch Alice Sweet Alice on YouTube because I went to get my DVD. I can't remember who put it out now. It was Synapse or somebody. It was quite an old DVD. And I opened up the box and it was empty. Don't you hate that when it happens?
Mm. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, no. That would drive me insane.
Yes. So anyway, I was able to watch it. It's on YouTube, but obviously not in the best quality print, but at least it's watchable. And Joseph, how are you doing?
I'm quite well, and I have not done any cheating as of yet.
As of yet. But you're open to offers?
Maybe.
Okay, right. So keeping your cards close to your chest, but yes. So, we're going to be talking Alfred Soul's very influential. Well, it's influential. I guess it arguably was, but certainly beautifully made proto-slasher Alice Sweet Alice in a short while. Before we do that, let's discuss some things we've been watching since the last podcast. I know it's only been a week since we recorded, but Bill, what have you been watching recently you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah. So yesterday I watched Hounds of Love. It's available on Amazon as a as an on-demand item. Have you any of you seen that one?
Yes. No. I'm hearing good things.
Yeah. So it's a story about a teenage girl who's been, I guess, acting up since her parents separated, living with her mother, and she comes into contact with this couple that has this pattern of kidnapping teenage girls to torture, rape, and murder them. It's really grim. It's funny because some of the most disturbing films I've seen in the last few years have been things I heard about on your show, like the Poughkeepsie Tapes and Megan is Missing. And it's not quite as docudrama as this. It's not like as it's a little bit more stylized. Like, it almost reminded me of like those kind of like slightly morbid teenager driven art house kind of movies from the early 2000s, like Donnie Darko or The Virgin Suicides, like a lot more like, you know, attractively composed shots and like eerie slow motion. But the same kind of like really rough subject matter. I don't know. I think it's really effective, but it left me feeling really kind of wrung out and depressed through a lot of it. Maybe I'm just getting more sensitive to these kind of stories, but it's quite good, but it's a rough film. The other thing I saw this week was, have you ever seen a movie? It has several different titles. I saw it under the title Last House on Massacre Street, but it's also known as The Bride and The House That Cried Murder. It's a 1973 film. Do you know that one?
I haven't seen it, no.
I have seen, oh, I remember seeing lobby cards for it, and I'm thinking that looked quite interesting because it was like a woman in a bridal gown, sort of, you know, it looked quite sort of stabby, like a proto-slasher.
A stabby film.
But I don't think I've seen
it. Yeah. It's... So it just came out on Blu-ray through Code Red on a double bill with a David Hemmings directed film called Wild Little Bunch that I've never seen. It's kind of this odd PG rated film. It's about like this rich daddy's girl who's engaged to kind of an asshole guy, and she's been designing a house for them to live in that's got like very odd architecture. But after the wedding, she finds the new husband making out with a woman and flips out and attacks him, doesn't kill him, but then kind of disappears. And then the rest of the story kind of concentrates on this husband and his mistress kind of being harassed and having nightmares and seeing visions of this woman. It's interesting. I wouldn't say it's a great film. It's very 70s. It has a lot of cheesy dialogue, but it's like there's an idiosyncratic quality to it. Like it's once you've seen it, it's something you'll probably remember, even if it's a hard film to like necessarily recommend as a great undiscovered film. But it's, if you like early 70s, like kind of offbeat regional horror films from that period, it's engaging. But that's what I've seen lately.
Okay, no, it sounds interesting. If it's on Code Red, we probably will never see it. Sorry, the United States, but yeah, no, that sounds like it could be fun. So look out for that one. But yeah, it's not one I've seen.
It sounds like one that would be in Nightmare USA or something like that.
Well, that's, you know, it's funny because the guy that wrote it later directed Blood Rage, and I think Stephen Thrower is planning on writing about it in his follow up to Nightmare USA too. And I just picked up the Hack-O-Lantern Blu-ray that came out through Massacre Video. I didn't get a chance to rewatch the whole thing before we recorded. But just taking a peek at it, and it looks like night and day compared with the old videotapes of that. I don't know. I guess that's probably one you'll cover eventually on the show. But it looks amazing compared to how Hack-O-Lantern used to look.
Okay, cool. That sounds great. So, yeah, I'm sure that is one we're going to cover at some point on the show. But thank you, Bill. Is there anything else you watched?
I think that's it.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, thank you. Nathan, how about you?
Well, aside from Burial Ground, which we discussed in our little mini episode for Patreon, I watched Don't Hang Up last night, which is a newer movie about these like YouTube prank kind of guys that pull these pranks that actually, you know, I imagine most people would consider going too far. I mean, they're doing pranks like calling a mother in the middle of the night saying there's people in her house and her daughter's in danger. And then they're calling people saying that they're, you know, child died in a car wreck and pretend to be police officers. I mean, it's pretty mean-spirited pranks. And then somebody kind of turns the tables on them and kidnaps, you know, one of them's parents and the other one's girlfriend and, you know, kind of like does some mental torture to them throughout the movie. I liked it. I would probably give it maybe a 6.5 out of 10, not quite a 7. I think one issue that I may have had with it is I do think that we're supposed to feel sympathy for the YouTube pranksters, but they're tools. You know, at the beginning of the movie, to me, they were very unlikable at the stuff that they're doing. And then when people get mad, like they just start cussing at them and stuff. It's, you know, they're kind of douches, I guess, in a way. I still really enjoyed the movie, and I thought it was kind of interesting in the whole, like, it takes that whole a prank going too far, but it's more in the modern age, because I could see something like this, you know, I mean, not to this extent, but something similar to this happening in real life, because you see pranks on YouTube all the time, and a lot of prank channels, you know, will try to, you know, one-up each other. And I'm like, you know, how far eventually will be too far before something bad happens, which is kind of what this movie does. I enjoyed it enough. It's probably just a one-time watch for me, but, you know, I liked it.
Cool. That's not one I've heard of. But, yeah, it's kind of got – sounds like it suffers from the usual kind of new movie thing of having RSL characters that you don't root for, but anyone else seen it? Sorry,
no.
I didn't want to interrupt you, because I know what will happen if I interrupt it, Nathan.
I was just going to say, like, it's not, like, I mean, it's one of those films where, I mean, I think the characters are supposed to be unlikable, but I think by the, you know, like, throughout the movie, you're supposed to kind of sympathize with what they're going through, and it halfway succeeded. I mean, I did, you know, probably particularly for one character more than the other one. I had a little more sympathy, but I don't know. But, I mean, I liked the ending. I thought it was ironic. So, I mean, it's not – I just don't want people to think it's just watching, like, snotty characters and, you know, like we talk about with a lot of modern slashers. It's not quite like that. I think the intent was to make them unlikable, but by the end make you kind of have – you know, some sympathy for them, which, you know, like I said, I might have had some sympathy, maybe just not full sympathy.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you, Nathan. Is there anything else?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Joseph, how about you?
Well, the only thing I've seen this week was the new movie that came out, It Comes at Night. It's being marketed as one of the scariest horror films of recent years, but it's not really a horror film at all. It's basically about a guy and his family. There's a deadly virus that's taken over the country. And, you know, so he basically, you know, goes out of his way to protect his family from being infected by this virus. And then, you know, out of nowhere, this guy and his family shows up and they break into his house for supplies. And yeah, after they all learn about each other a little bit more, they decide to kind of cooperate with one another to, you know, to kind of sustain their, I guess, their lives, as it were. But then, you know, things kind of spiral out of control. They get a little more understanding of what the virus is and all that good stuff. I liked it. I think it's being kind of oversold. Like I said, it's being oversold as a horror film. It's not a horror film at all. It's actually very, very morose and downbeat, kind of a suspense drama more so than a horror film. It's a good little movie though. Some very good acting, some wonderful cinematography. You know, like I said, it's very dark. It's not a movie you could go back and rewatch over and over for entertainment value. It's more just kind of, wow, that was a gut punch. But, no, I'd give it a marginal recommendation. I mean, a lot of these films I do look for, you know, I do give a lot of points for technical craft, so I give that, you know, I give points for that. But, you know, a lot of movies, I just want to be entertained. And I went into this thinking it's going to be kind of a, you know, a white knuckle kind of, ooh, grab the armrest next to you and just hold on for the ride. But it's not really like that at all. So it's not something I could see myself ever watching again. But at the same time, I do recommend it.
So it's a little bit like kind of how it was sold, The Witch was sold to audiences.
Yeah. I've still yet to see The Witch, but it reminds me of that kind of, oh, it's the scariest movie ever, and it's not really even a horror film, but that's what It Comes at Night is, actually, basically.
Is that that's a title that's completely bypassed me. Is that in cinemas or?
Yeah, it's out of cinemas.
Has anyone else seen that? More
no.
Interest in seeing it?
I don't know. Just after The Witch, I'm not 100% sure I'd be that enthusiastic.
Yeah.
See, I really like The Witch, so I think I'll like this one.
Yeah, I think you guys would both like it. I think all of you would like it, but at the same time, just go in. Don't go in expecting, you know, popcorn, you know, fun time. It's very morose and very kind of cynical and nihilistic. But so it's a well-made movie, but I wouldn't call it an entertaining film at all.
Cool. Excellent. Right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Anything else?
No, I mean, we just recorded last week, so
yeah,
kind of scarce in that area.
Okay, well, just going to touch on something very quickly before we come to Eric and myself, but just Nathan mentioned that we just recorded Burial Ground, so if you're wondering what that was, we're doing like a mini-sode for our Patreon supporters. So we just did Burial Ground, which is a lot of fun to talk about, a little mini-sode, about half an hour or so. So if you'd like us to talk crap about non-slasher movies, horror movies, then all you need to do is become a Patreon supporter, and that can be as little as a dollar, or I don't know what the minimum amount is, but it helps support the show. So we'll be playing details about how you can do that a little bit later, but that will be going out at the end of this month, I think, Joseph. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're going to put it out at the very end of the month, and then the following month, July, we'll do another Patreon little episode, 30-minute episode. It's one Nathan has picked, and I'm not going to tell you what that is, but I think you'll like that one as well. So yeah, do go to patreon.com and look for The Hysteria Continues, and you support us and we give back.
Exactly. Well, yes. And talking of people who put out, Eric, how's
Hey.
You been watching?
Well, before I let's go into what I'm watching, I'm curious to know, has anyone else apart from me seen Alien Covenant?
No.
Bill, have you seen it?
I have seen it, yes.
And what did you think? Because I loved it, and I saw it just before it got released, and ever since then, all I'm hearing is negative reviews. And I'm thinking I must be the Nathan of the Alien universe.
How did you see it before it got released, Eric?
I went to a preview screening.
Okay.
Justin, yes. So yeah, at that stage, there was only two or three reviews on, and they were quite positive. And I was like, yay, this is brilliant. And then ever since, all I'm hearing is people bitch about the film. So,
yeah, no, I liked it. I liked Prometheus also, so I'm probably not the most trustworthy person. But
I liked Prometheus too.
Yeah, no, what's weird is that I thought that, you know, all the Ridley Scott movies seem like they come out like a year later in a much longer version. And it felt like the last half hour of the Alien Covenant felt like, like maybe it was cut down to be a half hour, because it almost feels like the first film in Fast Forward, like it just goes so quickly through all the events. But yeah, no, I thought, I wasn't going expecting it to be better than Alien, but just a fun, you know, monster movie. And I think it delivers as far as that goes. I don't know what people were thinking it would be, but yeah, no, I thought the cast was good. I thought some of the set pieces with the action were quite scary, but yeah, and I thought some of the dialogue with the flute was funny.
Yes. Well, you blow and I'll do the fingering. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I'm getting sometimes a little bit burned out on a lot of remakes and sequels lately, but you know, I thought that was a fun one. So yeah, I'm in the same pro Alien Covenant boat as you are.
Yay. So my other recently seen, and this is actually applicable to you, but Bill as well, because I've been looking at the Phantasm box set that Arrow recently brought out, and Bill has written liner notes for the booklet that comes with it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. To my surprise.
Why to your surprise?
Because I'm not really a horror journalist. I had some friends that have been working on Arrow projects, and they knew that I had written a lengthy essay that had gone as yet unpublished about the early coming of age films of Don Coscarelli. And so I pitched it to them, and they took it. But it's just very surreal to me that it's in a book with Kim Newman.
It's great. It's really good.
Thank you.
I've watched all five films over the past month or whatever it is. And so I will just say briefly that I love the first one. Two and three I really like. Four I'm kind of iffy on. It's grown on me slightly more over the years. And then there's the new one, Phantasm Ravager, which this is my first time watching it earlier this week. It was shot over the course of 7 or 8 years, apparently. And it picks up from the point where Phantasm Oblivion left off. My initial thoughts are I couldn't warm to it really at all. I found it a bit too confusing. It didn't really hold my interest. There were some good moments in it, and you see it in the trailer. There's shots of giant silver spheres, in the skies of this sort of post-apocalyptic landscape, and they're quite interesting, although they're quite brief in the film. And then there's all this stuff as well. It keeps cutting back to Reggie, played by Reggie Bannister. He's in a nursing home and suffering from dementia. So the idea is, has he imagined the entire Phantasm franchise in a sort of Patrick Duffy, Bobby Ewing coming out of the shower kind of way? And whilst that should probably be more interesting than it was. I just couldn't get into it. And, there are parts of the film that should be like totes emosh. That's the way I feel anyway. I couldn't engage at all. So it probably warrants another watch, but I wasn't expecting much from Phantasm Ravager, to be honest, because I'd heard mixed reviews of it and I knew it was quite low budget. But there's interesting bits in it. I do like the giant spheres taking over the world were good, but overall a bit disappointing. But the box set is amazing. As I said, it comes with that booklet with all the various different writings in it, and it has a silver sphere that you can piece together. It's quite a nice little object.
Yeah, I've got that as well. I started to finger my way through it. But yeah, no, it looks a fantastic sort of box set, and I watched the feature length documentary, which I think is from a few years back. I think it's
I think I've seen that then. Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, fantastic box set. So yeah, urge everyone who've got any interest in Phantasm films to pick that up. So, anything else, Eric?
I don't know, Bill. Have you seen Phantasm Ravager?
You know, I actually haven't. I saw like a 15-minute extended trailer with Coscarelli, Angus Scrimm, and the rest of the cast all there in when they were at Texas Frightmare. Maybe was it last year? And they showed that clip before they showed the original film in 35mm and did live commentary. So I've seen a big chunk of it, but I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch the film yet. I've only heard negative things. I think you've actually given the kindest review I've heard so far of it.
Yeah, this is actually the first Phantasm film not directed by Don Coscarelli, so that may be why it feels a bit limp, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I met the guy, and he was really nice, that director.
No, he seems really nice on the extras night, he seemed, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Eric. I just to mention, I've been actually watching Versailles, which is completely non-horror related, so I won't talk about that. But one film I did catch up, which I've never seen, has been a bit of a blind spot for me, was Firestarter, Drew Barrymore, from 1984. I've never seen it before, and so I got it on Love Film. I don't know if it's out on Blu-ray. It's out, the version we saw was like a really, really shit kind of DVD transfer. Remember back in the days when DVDs came out, they'd even like it's quite a high budget film relatively, but it's just very soft. It didn't, but I hadn't seen it before, and I just thought because it was a bit of a blind spot for me, I thought I'd kind of catch up with it. And I quite enjoyed it. It's quite silly. Drew Barrymore is really good in it. I mean, I don't know how old she is, but she's not, she's probably only about 6 or 7 or maybe a little bit older. And it's got George C. Scott as this kind of evil kind of mastermind who kind of pretends to be a janitor and befriends Drew Barrymore, whose parents, I can't remember the guy's name, but it's Heather Locklear, is a mother who gets gets murdered and left on an ironing board, I seem to remember.
David Keith,
that's right. Okay, and yeah. Thank you. And they get given some kind of experimental drugs in a kind of test in a laboratory with other people, and I think they're the only people who survive, but I don't know if she gets any special powers, but he gets this kind of, he's able to control minds and make people do things they don't necessarily want to do. And their baby, Drew Barrymore, grows up and she has the power of basically being able to set things on fire, hence the title Firestarter. When she gets angry, she kind of gets, you know, she can't control it. And so it's kind of that kind of stand, kind of in some ways a bit kind of overused plot. I don't know if it was at that point. It's something that's kind of very 70s. I think it's the Parallax View, or those kind of films where you've got, I don't know if it was Parallax View, but you know, those 70s films where you've got like faceless kind of FBI or kind of intelligence agencies, like kind of goons driving around in sedan, you know, in cars and sort of chasing people down. And you've got very much with this, it's this, you know, they're trying to get hold of her with this kind of shadowy government, or maybe not government, kind of bodies trying to track her down to utilize her powers for nefarious reasons.
I.e. Stranger Things.
Well, exactly. Yeah, very much like Stranger Things. Yeah. And it's got Martin Sheen in it as well, who inexplicably goes from being a baddie to a goodie at some point throughout the movie. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it's got very fiery climaxes, you imagine. So if you like films where you see a kind of cherubic little blonde girl blowing people up and setting them on fire, then that's a film for you. But, yeah, I'd like to see it at some point, and again, on the better quality.
Scream Factory have released it.
Oh, have they? Okay, well, yeah. There you go. So maybe I'll catch up with it again. But, yeah, it's kind of, it's silly, but it's quite good. It's quite good, you know, it's quite good fun. I kind of take it as kind of film that I'm probably the lone person who hasn't seen it before. So, but has anyone seen that recently?
Not recently. I saw it years ago, but I do remember quite liking it and being quite surprised that I liked it, because I'd heard, people weren't saying it was awful, but everyone was saying it was quite mediocre. So I was surprised it was enjoyable. I'm taken by Joseph's sigh that he doesn't like it.
No, I haven't seen it in like 30 years, but I saw it at the theater with my mother and I want to say my aunt or something. And I remember there was a little girl just crying through the whole movie because she was scared. I'd kind of like to catch up with it again.
Was that Justin?
It's been so long. Yeah, it may have been.
I've never
Justin,
seen it before, but, Eric, as I've just pointed out. So maybe it was you.
I would have said that Drew Barrymore in the film was more like Eric throwing little fiery tantrums.
She was a very flaming Inga, which is.
I'm not a flaming Inga.
You're a flaming Peter Bark.
Yes. So, yeah, so that's kind of. But what about you, Bill? Have you seen Firestarter?
Not in a long time. Yeah. I actually had been to some of the locations from that when I lived in North Carolina, because that's where it was shot. All those Dino De Laurentiis films were shot down there. Mm. I think one of the plantations up around there had been used as a location. But yeah, I haven't seen it since probably like the early 80s, I think.
Okay, yeah. No, and imagine, what about you, Nathan? I kind of guess that's probably a film you haven't seen for a while.
Oh, yes. I mean, I couldn't tell you the last time I saw it. I only really remember, like, bits and pieces from it, actually.
Mm-hmm. So, that was our recently seen, but we are going to move on now to our feature presentation. So, here is the trailer for Alice, Sweet Alice.
Brooke Shields. In holy terror. Alice was too old to play with dolls and too young to make love. Brooke Shields, as you've never seen her before. She was too beautiful to play with boys and too young to play with men. So Alice began to play with death.
She's made a repeated request that the kids see a psychiatrist.
She has a knack of making things look like accidents.
No more dolls, no more toys. Alice only plays with bodies. It's too late to save her.
Help me, please! Someone help me!
story of unnatural love and unnatural death. Brooke Shields, in Holy Terror. It's too late for prayers.
Okay. If you can survive this night, nothing will scare you. Who is the murderer behind the mask? Is sweet 12-year-old Alice capable of killing her young sister minutes before she will receive her first Holy Communion? Or is it someone else with a vicious plan that is haunting her family? Watch in terror and suspense as Brooke Shields makes her film debut in this shocking thriller directed by Alfred Soul. So Alice Sweet Alice, I mean, the reason I picked it, for me, I guess Black Christmas and Alice Sweet Alice are probably my favorite proto slashers. I guess those are the two I most screen for, non-horror fanatics. I think that they both have a lot of qualities that make them still quite scary that they haven't really dated. Yeah. So Alice Sweet Alice has like a really interesting blend of styles. Cause on the one hand, it's really influenced by Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, kind of more of an art house film. Like it kind of sheds the experimental aspects of that, but a lot of the horror elements remain, like the everything from like the raincoated little killer, and like almost the feel of a giallo. And it has, you know, concentrates on adult characters and grieving parents, also like a Hitchcock feel. Like, I mean, there's three staircase stabbings versus Psycho's one, but it's but also kind of merges like the I guess like the perverse strangeness of something like the original Sleepaway Camp, but kind of look points towards something like that. Like it has the weird troubled teenage girl who may or may not be the killer, and this kind of sleazy underbelly, like not quite as full on as Sleepaway Camp, but I'd say more than something like Friday 13th or Halloween or things of that ilk. It feels a lot more perverse in places. And like the way certain female characters are made up and like the oddly mannered acting, like it almost reminds me more of Aunt Martha in Sleepaway Camp than, you know, something like Friday 13th. And also some of the odd comedy, like the Monsignor's line about wanting his cake now, almost reminds me of David Lynch a little bit. So it's, and you know, the, like all of the, like the odd and creepy dolls and knickknacks, remind me of another New Jersey, slasher oddity, Christmas Evil. Like it has a lot of different things that, are interesting for me about it. And it's interesting also, cause like, you know, I mentioned like sleaziness and like Alfred Soul, you know, had previously made, Deep Sleep, this porno comedy, and it's weird because like Alice Sweet Alice feels like pretty chaste in terms of like the erotic content. Like it's not really as like a sexy film like say Friday 13th Part 5. I think some of the elements of it also remind me of early Dario Argento, like the Burbo Crystal Plumage. Like it has like this urban adult feel, but it also has like the childlike La La kind of soundtrack. It might be a Rosemary's Baby thing. Even like the eerie breathing phone call, like it's almost giallo like for a film, you know, shot in the U.S. It's funny because like that's maybe what makes it personal for me is that my grandfather worked in that city, Paterson, New Jersey. It was like a, you know, an hour from where I grew up, and I've been to a lot of those camps, like in the in North Jersey, like where they shot Friday 13th. Like I grew up, you know, surrounded by a lot of slasher locations, but that's the film that feels most like my childhood to me is Alice Sweet Alice, as far as like, I, you know, I remember how that city looked, even though it's kind of like playing period. Like, it's, I don't think I even thought of it as a 60s setting the first time I saw it, because they don't really comment on it. And, you know, I guess now looking at it now, like, oh, the fashions are clearly kind of setting that up. But, you know, I never thought of it as a period from the first, when I, you know, when I first saw it as I was growing up. But, yeah. And also just the, as someone that was raised Catholic, you know, it feels like an oddly personal film for the director. Like it's, you know, it's like the same period as something like Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets, which is also dealing with, heavy Catholic guilt themes, like in a crime film setting. But I don't know, it has like a lot more going on than a lot of slasher movies. So I thought, you know, I thought it was something that you would also all like, which is why I picked it. Maybe I'm wrong, but I knew that Axum was on your lineup. So I had some mercy on you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Oh, God.
Don't mention that A word.
Well, talking of A words, Eric, what was your thoughts on that?
Oh, you mean because I'm awesome?
Yeah.
Thanks.
That's the word I was stretching for.
Yeah, I like Alice Sweet Alice quite a lot. I think it's really good. It's very well made. But for me, perhaps it's a little too bleak and maybe it's not enough fun to be what I would call a regular watch, so it wouldn't be something I would return to very often. And watching it this week was the first time I'd seen it in over a decade, I'd say. I find it also maybe a bit overlong at 108 minutes. And my other issue, it sounds like I hate the film, but my other issue is I find there's no real one character to root for in the film. I do love the European feel that you're saying. It feels like a giallo in places, and it reminds you of early Dario Argento. And it reminded me also, because of the sort of Catholic setting, it reminds me of the Euro Exorcist ripoffs like Antichrist, or giallos that are set in around religious settings like Don't Torture a Duckling and House with the Laughing Windows. And that grey overcast aesthetic gives the film a real 70s feel. It felt really sort of William Friedkin-ish. It had the same look as The Exorcist, I thought. Again, but my problem is the character of Alice is so loathsome, I find, and annoying, that it kind of prevents me from enjoying the movie to a certain degree. And it's the same issue that I had with The Babadook, which was where the characters were so shrill that I couldn't engage with the film. And Alice and her mother in this film, I find I can't connect with them at all. Father Tom is kind of the one sympathetic character I find in the film. Having said that, I do think the killer is really creepy. I love the Don't Look Now influence, which the director has admitted was an influence. You know, the killer is of diminutive stature and wearing a mac. It's yellow here where it was red in Don't Look Now. The mask is also really creepy with its sort of blank facial features. You know, not, I suppose, a million miles away from The Shape in Halloween. It has that type of effect. And sort of when they attack Anne on the stairs and Dom in the abandoned looking building, they're the real standout scenes for me in the film when it becomes more of a slasher film. Also, I think once the killer's identity is revealed, because the killer's identity is the killer's unmasked with sort of 40 minutes to go in the film, which is unusual. I think things really move up a gear at that stage. I'm guessing some people probably think it slows down, but for me, I those final 30, 40 minutes are really, really good. So I don't want to say any more, because I'd be going into spoiler territory. So I'm not sure if we're ready to actually reveal who the killer is yet. So, but I will say I do love the movie, but it's one I can't watch too often, just because it's not what I would call a fun movie. It's not a popcorn movie for me. But it's so incredibly well made, and it's just a surprise. Alfred Sohl only went on to make two or three more films after this before he went into sort of more behind the scenes stuff on films. But yeah, terrific movie. Big thumbs up. I can see why people adore the film. I wouldn't say I adore it. I quite like it. I do like, no, I not that's that's too tame. I really like the film, but yeah, not one I watch very often.
Okay, well, thank you, Eric. Nathan, how about you?
I love Alice, Sweet Alice. I actually, the movie itself actually means a lot to me, because my grandfather, who has since passed away, would watch horror movies with me. And this was the first one that he and I watched together. And he knew that I liked it, so he went out and bought it for me on VHS. It was a double feature of Alice, Sweet Alice, and Psychomania, the motorcycle gang horror movie. And I watched that tape until it broke. He and I would talk about Alice, Sweet Alice, which was, I mean, it's kind of a fun memory for me. The movie itself, I love the film. I think the music is fantastic. I love the soundtrack to this movie. I love the opening scene with, the girl doing, saying communion. What is she saying? Is it the rosary? Or, I mean, I don't know much about the Catholic side, but, you know, she's saying that, you know, pray for sinners now unto the hour of our death, amen. And she's repeating that over and over. And the cross that she has actually has a blade on it. And I thought that was a great way to open the movie. It's one of my favorite, like, credits sequences. I probably disagree with Eric a little bit. I actually really liked Alice and her mother. I do think that there were times that they got way too shrill. But I could kind of see why Alice was jealous. Because, I mean, you got everybody fawning over your sister and how amazing she is and how pretty and all this stuff. And I feel like Alice just sort of the Jan Brady of the family who's getting, you know, just getting kind of ignored. Or, you know, I mean, I do think the mom loves her and everything, but it's just the Brooke Shields character, you know, she gets, you know, a majority of the attention, you know. And honestly, she was probably the one that got on my nerves mostly because, I mean, of course, you are talking about a little girl, but, you know, she's very whiny. The scene where Alice, like, is putting on her veil, she's, like, sitting, you know, whining, like, make her take it off. I don't know. I can understand Alice, you know.
Hey, she was being bullied. She was being totally bullied, and she had every reason to be whinging.
I was picturing Eric when Alice threw the veil on the floor. It would be like Justin, like, throwing, you know, stuff on the floor, and Eric just being like, it's ruined.
Well, this is a nice analogy. I can't remember Brooke Shields' character, but I'm her. And
Karen.
Karen. And Justin's Alice. That's the way it is.
I can see Eric Sweet Eric is a much better title.
Eric Sweet Eric. There you go. I love the scene with Brooke Shields, Karen, at the church, because her whole death scene, you know, it's kind of jarring, especially, like, not only the, you know, her being strangled, you know, just like in another room, like with, you know, her whole, you know, family and all these other people, you know, just in the room next door. And she's being strangled. And then on top of that, you know, having her body set on fire at the church, it's, you know, it's a crazy sequence. And to talk about this next part, I'm probably going to have to spoil it. So spoiler alert for everybody.
But we don't do spoilers, Nathan.
No, we never do. The killer turns out to be Father Tom's housekeeper, Mrs. Tredoni, and she's played by Mildred Clinton. And there is a scene that is always very unnerving to me, even when I've seen the movie as many times as I've seen it. It's when you know, Alice's mother goes to visit Father Tom, and Mrs. Tredoni's the only one there, and she's kind of making, I think she's preparing for dinner. And there's just, like, this moment when Mrs. Tredoni's talking to her normally, you know, but then she goes back into the kitchen and she just has this moment where it's like, it's, you could tell that it's basically killing her to try to put on this, you know, friendly face to this woman who she has nothing but contempt for. And I thought the acting that she did there was just incredible. It was just such a great scene. And then the scene where, you know, Father Tom comes home and is, you know, has to basically let, you know, the mother know that Dom has been murdered as well. You can hear her, like, grieving and, you know, screaming in the next room. And Mrs. Tredoni just kind of hacks that fish head off and, like, wipes it across her apron. I just love that moment in the film. It's such a great scene. And the finale in the church, it's just, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I absolutely love this movie. It was one of the first horror movies I ever saw. So it's always going to hold a special place in my heart because of that. I cannot praise it enough.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, Nathan. Joseph, how about you?
Well, I saw this for the first time many, many years ago. And I remember loving it, but if I'm honest now, I'm a little on the fence about it. I think it's a very atmospheric film with some, you know, pretty stellar acting from pretty much everyone all around. I mean, like, I think it was Eric who said that some of the acting is a little labored, but I think it kind of, I think with the storyline, it kind of adds to it a little bit. But my problem is that, and this is kind of unfair, but lately I've been studying religion a lot, you know, and I was kind of hoping for more of the kind of inner and outer workings of the Catholic Church. And I mean, there's a little bit here, but it's I was kind of hoping up for a little bit more, I guess, just to kind of give the film that extra little nuance, as it were. But it's kind of I wouldn't say missing, but kind of, you know, lackluster in that department. Now, having said that, I do think the film is well made. I think it's, you know, it's very atmospheric. I love the you know, like you said, the rain slicker killer. What Eric says about it was Eric who said about Alice. I agree. She's kind of a snotty little child, so it's kind of hard to root for her. And I find a lot of the I guess you'd call it the middle portion of the film. It's kind of stretched thin. I think the runtime, the original cut, it's 108 minutes, and I know there's a 98 minute version. It's a cut version. I think if you're going to cut this film down to 98 minutes, that would be preferable. You know, not so much do away with some of the more garish moments of murder and mayhem, but maybe cut some of the kind of the family crises moments down a little bit. I mean, I kind of, if I'm honest, my eyes wandered a little bit this time around. I did get a kick out of the, and I'm wondering if Eric had a thing for Alfonso.
No. I knew this subject was going to come up, and it's a definitive no. There's big and then there's big.
Yeah, I think they're obviously they were going for sort of a Marlon Brando type there with him fanning himself in his hot apartment, and he's in that wife beater, and I got a kick out of that character. I mean, he's kind of, you know, we were talking about earlier on the burial ground little mini-sode thing we did for Patreon, how you can't really keep your eyes off Peter Bark because he's just kind of this weird little force of nature in the film. I found him, the Alfonso character, every time he's on screen, it's like, you're just like, this guy is just so kind of strange and bizarre, and he's like this kind of low rent Marlon Brando clone, and I got a kick out of that, and I liked a lot of the murder scene where she, Miss Trudoni, stabs what's her name, Catherine, or no, she stabs
Anne,
thinking it was Catherine. I love that scene. But I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence. I'm not going to say I don't recommend it or I do recommend it. I'm kind of, you know, on the line, kind of in a gray area of whether or not I would recommend it. As it's not popcorn thrills. It's more kind of, like I was saying about kind of, it comes at night. It's kind of morose, kind of dour. It's just not a very fun movie. It's well made, and it definitely, you know, earns its spot as kind of this important proto slasher, but it's not something I would see myself going back to watch over and over, if I'm honest. And I remember, you know, this was a movie I had watched a lot, you know, growing up, but, you know, as I'm getting up in years, I just don't see myself having the fortitude to kind of, you know, go back and watch it again, if I'm honest. Sorry, Bill, and especially Nathan, because I know he loves the film. But that's my two cents on the film.
Okay, well, thank you, Joseph. For me, I kind of fall on the side of Nathan. Really, I really love this movie. I think it's a really interesting movie. It's very well done. I can see what Eric was saying about it not being a kind of popcorn movie. And again, it's not a film that I would necessarily go back to, you know, over and over and over again, although I have done, but it's not a film you chuck on if you just want something kind of a kind of soothing, like comfort horror, basically, because it's a bit more challenging than that. I mean, it also has a kind of special resonance for me because I too was brought up Catholic, and I actually went through First Holy Communion, so where they kind of dressed the little girls as brides of Christ and the boys in kind of like in suits, so it had that kind of like creepy resonance for me. And especially as a kind of, very lapsed Catholic or ex-Catholic like Alfred Sowell, then it kind of that kind of religious iconography, I thought it was interesting, because I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before. But when I was going to church, it was back, you know, when I was young, but, you know, when I was taken to church, not under my own volition, but it was in Latin. It was that long ago. So again, it kind of has that kind of special kind of that sort of weird resonance for me. And I sort of remember our priest, Father Reynolds, he used to kind of basically, if you know, it was like a military maneuver, the rehearsal for the First Holy Communion. And if you got things wrong, he would smack people, little kids around the head. They were like, you know, sort of the same age as Brooke Shields' character is in this film. So it was kind of, yeah. It kind of so that was all kind of weird. I really liked the kind of period detail. But as Bill was saying, you kind of, when you're watching it, it's almost kind of, you have to wonder why Alfred Sowell decided to set it in the 1960s, because in 1961, apart from perhaps, I imagine that was kind of when he was the kind of age, he might have been around the age or that the kind of the children's characters were. I don't know. I know he's in his 70s now. But it kind of it has that kind of kitchen sink drama going on. And it kind of starts with the you know, like the happy family, apart from obviously Alice, who's got very jealous of his of her little sister. But everyone else, it seems to be, you know, it's literally you get the feeling that they are kind of like a happy family, although they obviously the parents are divorced. But everyone, it's kind of it's just normal life. And then for the mother, things just get worse and worse and worse as people around her start dying. And it's kind of bookended by those two fantastic sequences in the church, with the first sequence with Brooke Shields' character being shoved in a, you know, murdered and shoved in a box and set on fire by the killer. And then the kind of very quite tense sequence at the end with the killer taking first taking Holy Communion at the church and you know, killing another character before she's led away. So I thought that was, you know, it's kind of really really well done. I think it's quite tense. I like the mask. I've actually got some of those masks. We bought some. They're not the same ones, but they I think they're kind of like the kind of dime store masks from the 1950s 1960s. They're kind of like translucent thing, which I think are particularly creepy. I mean, it is derivative of Don't Look Now. But I think it's, considering that Alfred Sol came off making, you know, a porno, which I haven't seen, nothing against that, but it's kind of... It's,
yeah, he's probably not the only one who came off making porno.
Oh, Eric. but it's, I thought it was, it's just, it's very assured. It's just, you know, beautifully shot. You know, just, it was kind of, you know, again, it's kind of, you know, he's acknowledged his sources, although he did say that he'd not seen any of Dario Argento's films. So in some ways he was influenced by, as Bill was saying, by Hitchcock with the kind of Nicholas Roeg, but he just in the same way as the Giallo were influenced and shaped by Psycho and you know, Hitchcock, so came to it at that same kind of space. But yeah, it's certainly not, you know, if you're in the mood for a Friday 13th or a My Beloved Valentine or a Hell Night, then this isn't really going to the movie that you're going to want to sit down and sort of munch popcorn to. But I think,
although Mrs. Trelawney is kind of a prototype for Mrs. Voorhees.
She is, yes. I think it was kind of, I like the, yeah, she was. I mean, she has that, and I think Nathan was saying that her character, that the actress is incredible in this. I mean, she's
brilliant, yeah.
It could go quite cheesy, couldn't it? It could become a little bit kind of, you know, bug-eyed and sort of gnashing your teeth. And she kind of has that whole kind of weird sort of thing down to pat, that kind of, her kind of, this mask of sanity, because she's supposedly like a kindly, you know, Catholic kind of you know, carer, like housekeeper, you know, she's, you know, she hates all these characters because they're not good enough Catholics. So it's kind of subversive as well as, and again in the mid 1970s, I forget. I mean, certainly in places like Italy, where they were doing a lot of quite subversive kind of. We talked about this before, about a lot of the giallo had like priests as killers, and Pete Walker's films like The Confessional. Or the Rosary Murders, kind of, you know, a killer priest in that. So although the priest isn't a killer in this, in fact the priests are painted as being quite quite nice and quite sort of decent people, it's actually somebody who's been kind of ruined by religion, and then kind of uses religion as a justification for doing heinous acts. So
although is she not driven to do what she does because she is so. Well, in love, I suppose, with Father Tom, and then she sees his family trying to infiltrate his life, so she goes out of her way to destroy them. That's what I read into it.
I think you're right. I feel like the core of it was her jealousy, but I think that she justified it in using the religion as her justification, although I think it just came down to jealousy as well.
Mm. But I think there was definitely a Catholic, you know, it's like when she tried to give her the confession, didn't she? She didn't confess to, you know, she confessed to being a bit short-tempered with the old Monsignor with Alzheimer's. So I got an impression that it was kind of a criticism of religion.
Yeah, I mean, and I would agree with you on that as well, because I was thinking back to that one scene that I'd mentioned, you know, where it's just her and Catherine. In the kitchen, and she gives the speech, you know, that she lost her, you know, child as well, and that she gives a little speech that, you know, she thinks that God takes, you know, the children to punish the parents. So, I mean, I could see that too.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And also, I mean, I think, Brooke Shields is kind of, The trailer I found for Holy Terror, which I'm going to talk a little bit about the background and the release, the different releases it got. But you know, Brooke Shields is not in the movie much at all. I mean, she
no.
I
was thinking. Yeah. I haven't watched that trailer, Justin, but listening to the audio of it, it sounded like it really misrepresents the movie.
I was thinking that too. It does.
I mean, I kind of grabbed the first one I saw, and but re-listening to it, because it does basically, you watch it and it's lots of kind of the killer in the mask, and it's kind of making out that Brooke Shields is potentially the killer, but it's also kind of saying, and it's talking about Alice, but sort of saying about, you know, she's too young for boy, or sort of like, you know, kind of it's
too young to make love or something. They said it's like, ooh, creepy.
But obviously, Brooke Shields kind of got infamy from being in is it Louis Malle or was it Pretty Baby?
Pretty Baby from Louis Malle.
Yeah, and which was kind of a controversial film at the time about child prostitutes. So it's kind of this kind of weird, almost kind of like quite disturbing kind of idea of trying to sell it to an audience that you're going to, you know, you've got Brooke Shields in a kind of sexy role, which is kind of really adds another layer of weirdness. And you've got the Alfonso character who's this kind of predatory kind of paedophile, and he's kind of but Alice is kind of playing with him, not in that way, but she's kind of like, she's kind of taunting him and he's kind of taunting her, and there's that really horrible scene which you'll kind of always forget about, and I kind of always catches me off guard, is the scene with the kitten.
That's another reason why I hate Alice.
Yeah, I mean, it's effective in showing how unbalanced she is, and, you know, how spiteful she is. But, you know, I don't think the kitten was properly hurt, but certainly I don't think that kitten would have enjoyed that scene, put it that way. It's kind of, you've got Alice who even when she finds out her sister has been murdered, she doesn't seem particularly upset, does she? Even though we find out she had nothing to do with it. I think it's this kind of endless nightmare for the mother as well, because she just goes through this kind of endless, you know, everyone around her has been killed, and everyone thinks it's her daughter, and so she's got
Another thing that reminded me of The Exorcist is where it, like, she's like the Chris McNeil character, where it's just one bit of misery piled on top of another.
But I think it's kind of, I agree that it probably could be a little bit shorter. But I think it's going to book at the scene at the end in the church. I think it's really, really well done. And I think it's, I think it's a great little film. So thank you, Bill, for choosing it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm sorry that not everyone loved it as much as I do.
Well, no, look, Bill, I do love the movie. I think it's really effective, really good, really well made. It's just, it's not a popcorn movie.
It's a very grim film compared. Yeah,
I would agree. I think it's an important film, well made, but not something I could just rewatch over and over.
I can't say that because I've seen this movie I don't know how many times.
Yeah, I was going to say, you mentioned why was it set in the 1960s, and Alfred Soul had said it was because getting a divorce was a really big complication back then, and that was the reason.
Right.
Yeah, because I was wondering that, because like it would be the equivalent of setting, like, if you made a film today and setting it in 2002, it's like, why would you do that?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny also because you talk about the religion thing, and his previous film, the porno film, had a shot of, a bishop's house in it, in Patterson, because it was also shot in Patterson, and that created this whole scandal that involved like a legal case and the federal government, and basically a terrible nightmare for everyone involved with that film. There's actually an episode of the podcast Rialto Report just about Deep Sleep and that whole controversy, but it was because he used that house, and you could actually imagine him being prompted to get a lot more heavy about religion and criticizing it, because they really kind of, I mean, the film was, you know, yanked, all the money went away, and it was because of that, stepping on the toes of organized religion. So it's interesting that he would go back to those themes and have the full support of the city too, because they had access to everything when they shot that film.
That's interesting. I mean, do you want to sort of maybe talk us through some background on this, Bill? Because I know you've been looking into it. Mm.
Yeah. Let's see what I have. It was made independently over 24 days, not consecutively, for $400,000. It was raised independently. There's no cinematographer credit, really. There's no director of photography. I guess they had seven different cameramen over the course of the shoot. It won the gold medal at the Virgin Island Film Festival and a silver medal at the Chicago Film Festival, both in 1976. Alfred Soule had a background in painting and architecture and interior design. I don't know if he designed any of the buildings in the film, but if it has kind of a designed feel the way like a giallo might, it's because that was actually his pre-filmmaking background. I've been to a lot of the locations. Most of them have burned down now. What's interesting is that that church is actually not a church at all. It was the chapel inside the hospital, which I always found that surprising. It's a huge chapel for a hospital. but I guess it burned down after they shot the film. Linda Miller was Jackie Gleason's daughter, and I guess was real sensitive about that being brought up during the shoot. And I think Alfred Soule makes some comment in one interview about her like slashing her wrists during the shoot. I don't know if that's true or just, you know, hearsay, but I guess she was kind of a emotional volatile presence on the set. Only one of two films that Paula Shepherd made. She later did the very odd science fiction cult film Liquid Sky. What else? The clear mask was bought at a department store in Chinatown at a Halloween store. Is where they bought the fake blood. The pedophile element was inspired by M, the Peter Lorre film. I don't know if you want me to tell the story about the guy that plays the landlord. Is it Alphonse Noble, the Mr. Alfonso in the film? Mm. But he was a gay nightclub bouncer in Patterson, and famously used to dress up like a priest, hang around cemeteries, and say blessings over graves for money. but that's some background that I have.
Yeah, excellent. Because I know he wasn't a professional actor, was he? So, and it kind of adds that kind of, for me, that kind of adds that kind of weird quality as well to it, because his acting is quite mannered in a kind of, is kind of, which doesn't fit in with the others, but actually works for some reason.
Yeah, he's actually one of two people that wound up in Bloodsucking Freaks that same year.
Yeah, which is funny. So, thank you, Bill. Eric, have you got anything for us? Eric? Have we lost Eric?
Have we lost
Eric? No, sorry, no, I was muted, sorry, because I was playing with my fidget spinner.
Is that what you call it these days?
You're fired.
Well, it is red and hard. So Bill Lustig.
Tell us about Alfonso, your love.
I do not love Alfonso. Yes, no. No, he's too big. Bill Lustig worked as an uncredited effects artist, and he was an assistant cameraman on the film. He appears on the commentary track. It was recorded for the Laserdisc release, so I'm guessing it was done in the mid 90s at some stage. Apparently there was an error made in lodging the copyright for the film, so it fell into the public domain. So I don't think Alfred Soule has ever seen a cent of money from the success. Well, I don't know if it was a success as such, but he never saw any profits from the various releases of Alice, Sweet Alice. Soule originally wanted an actress called Geraldine Page to play Mrs. Trelawney. She'd been nominated for an Academy Award. Well, she went on to be nominated for an Academy Award seven times without winning, including in 1978 for the film Interiors by Woody Allen. But she declined the role, but recommended Mildred Clinton, which, as we said, was a very smart move because she is awesome in the film. Linda Miller, who plays the mother of Alice, is was the wife of Jason Miller from The Exorcist, and she's the mother of Jason Patrick, who apparently is an extra in the film, although when Alfred Soule was watching it on the commentary track, he said he couldn't spot him, but he said he was sure he was there. So the film was released in the UK as Communion in 1977, which was, its original title. And that's about all I have. Reissued, of course, is Holy Terror, then the early 80s, with a very, as we said, misleading trailer to make it sound probably more like a early 80s horror or slasher movie than it actually is. So that's about all I have. Justin, do you have more?
Well,
Nathan.
I better go for Nathan first, didn't I?
Yeah, you know how I am when I don't get picked.
Yeah.
Well, first off, you guys know the connection between Alice, Sweet Alice, and Friday the 13th, right?
Alice is a character in Friday the 13th, and she's sweet.
That's not the connection that I'm thinking of.
Okay.
Sandy, the waitress, is in Alice, Sweet Alice.
No way. Sandy's the big guy with the big glasses.
Yeah, with the, you know, red hair and, yeah, the diner waitress. Yeah, she plays a policewoman in Alice, Sweet Alice.
She was actually an actress?
Hmm?
What'd you say?
She was actually an actress. I thought she was just, I didn't.
You thought she was just an actual, you know. No, she's got, like, several credits.
Okay.
Whereabouts does she appear in Alice, Sweet Alice? Because I must go look for her, because I'm intrigued.
I do not remember exactly where she is in the movie. I feel like she's like, it was around the Brooke Shields death.
Okay.
When we see her. But I'm going to have to pull it up now and see if I can pinpoint exactly where she's at. But in the meantime, I had to hear the information about Linda Miller, and I actually thought it was really interesting, this whole thing about her cutting her wrists, you know, that Bill had mentioned, because I had read that same interview. So I was a little taken back when I read that part. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, he does mention in the interview that they've made peace with each other, and they've actually, you know, are friendly with each other now. It was just probably a rough time on set, I would imagine. Let's see. Paula Shepherd was 19 when she was playing the character of Alice, who's supposed to be a lot younger than that.
Yes, and, which is very Peter Barkish.
Yeah, exactly. The director, Alfred Soule, mentions on the commentary track that he did with Bill Lustig that, you know, one thing that was amusing behind the scenes is you'll have, you know, Paula Shepherd dressed, you know, like a young girl in pigtails and everything, but, you know, on the set she's smoking a cigarette because the thing is, she's really 19.
Yeah, but the thing is, unlike Peter Bark, she actually is really convincing as 11 or 12 she's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, I would have had no idea she was 19.
I had no clue either. It was definitely one of those, you know, kind of surprise moments for me. And let's see, that's all I have, to be honest, but I was actually surprised I had anything.
Well, thank you, Nathan. Thank you. Joseph, how about you?
I don't have any background info, but I do have a joke of the week for Alice, Sweet Alice.
I have a joke of the week as well.
Oh, my goodness.
We can have a joke of the week.
Okay. Well, who's going to go first then?
You go first, Eric.
Did you know that one of the actresses in Alice, Sweet Alice was fired from the set of the film 300? The props department complained because she went around and broke shields. She broke shields. It's like Brooke Shields. Because they would have used shields in the film 300.
Oh dear. Joseph, do you want to go next?
Do you know why they picked the director for this film that's about...
Start again.
I hear more joke of the week. Do you know why they picked the director they did for this film about religion and stuff like that?
No.
Because he had a soul.
Dear,
one was way better.
That's definitely well deserved, that trombone.
I got to give this one to Eric, I think.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah,
I just made mine up on the spot.
You can tell.
Oh, and Eric. But,
mine was well crafted throughout the week, because I know it's been a while since there was a joke of the week, so I went to my joke of the week.
What time did you get to bed last night coming up with that one?
Well, no, I've been working on that one all week.
Yeah, what time did you get to bed last night? It took you all week.
4 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. See, what I'm saying is I got mine right off the bat.
That's why it was
on yours.
Yeah, well, we could tell.
Yeah,
so stick that in your corn cob pipe.
Well, thank you.
I found Sandy, Eric.
Oh, whereabouts?
Sandy? Where is she?
It's when Dom goes to the police station to be interviewed by the police. He gets on the elevator with her.
Okay, I must have a look.
And you will see Sandy in a cop outfit instead of a waitress outfit.
Does she have the big glasses?
No, but she's got the same hair.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I haven't got most of it's been covered. The only thing, I think we've spoken about this before, but I used to have the pre-cert video release that was put in the UK called, under the Communion title. And it has on the front, it's one of the classic kind of, well, not classic, but it's kind of most infamous kind of spoilery kind of video covers, because it actually has the killer stabbing Alfonso, the landlord, in on the front cover. So
without the mask.
Without the mask. So it actually has old lady. You can see it's her and her killing, you know, stabbing the guy. So which is a major crime for a whodunit, really, isn't it?
Mm.
Well, that was Alice, Sweet Alice.
Can I just say, I was googling myself. No, I was googling Alice, Sweet Alice VHS art, and I came up with this, what looks like some kind of Scandinavian release, where it's using an image of a scantily clad woman who's probably in her mid-20s holding aloft a spiky knife thing of some sort. And it's actually the VHS art for a film called Raging Fury, which is an AKA for Hell High, which we've covered Hell High, haven't we? This is really, really misrepresenting the film. It's got, like, as I said, it looks more like it's House in Sorority Row or something than Alice, Sweet Alice.
Well, it's kind of, I think it was, somebody said, it might have been Bill, was sort of saying about the kind of, it slipped out of copyright, so it looks like lots of people were able to put it out. Also, just going to mention one other thing about the UK video release. It was it wasn't prosecuted for obscenity, but it was seized and confiscated in the UK under the Section 3 of the Obscene Publications Act 1959 during the Video Nasty Panic. So you know, even a film as good as Alice, Sweet Alice kind of felt the long arm of the law, which I thought was quite interesting. But yeah, so that anything else to say on that, Bill? Is there anything else you wanted to say before we wrap that up and get onto some feedback?
No, I think we've covered it.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you. A great choice. I hope you've enjoyed listening to that. Joseph, do we have some feedback of what people have said about the film off the Facebook?
Yes, we do.
We do.
We do.
Okay.
David Cook says, I first came across this movie as Communion, reviewed in an old copy of Hammer House of Horror, bought in the early 80s. Much later, I caught up with this on TV, I think as part of Alex Cox's Movie Drome. Rewatching it earlier this year, it really strikes me as an English language giallo, with its mass killer and set piece killings. Very atmospheric and memorable, and with a surprising early 60s setting. Bob Hartshorn says, a superior slasher featuring some great set pieces. The mouth injury sequence made me wince. Ouch. Expertly crafted with a highly satisfying twist. The Mark Ruffalo lookalike detective was cool, too. All in all, a class act. Let's see. Jenny Hall Cameron says, I've always wondered why this wasn't a bigger hit. Mr. Alfonso scared the you-know-what out of me when I was little. High creep factor with that dude. The actress playing Alice did a great job, although she was almost in her 20s by this point. Wish she went on to do more acting. She did another movie I never watched, and I think Eric mentioned that earlier. Loved the score to this movie, and the wearing of a rain slicker made me think of Don't Look Now, another movie I really enjoyed. Looking forward to hearing the podcast. I regret not doing something with this movie. I got it for $2.99 in a bin at Media Play. Ooh, I love Media Play. Looked at eBay and saw they were selling for 20-something. Was going to go back to buy them all to sell them on eBay, and someone else, I guess, had the same idea. They were all gone. Donna Nelly says, it's certainly fun as a slasher. Has some great set pieces and a shocking giallo-inspired twist. Does have a little too languid pace that keeps the body count a little low, but we're still in proto-slasher territory, so it's understandable. Overall, a rather fun effort. Sean McFall says, first watched this way back in the early 80s. It was on BBC Two during the summer when they used to have a horror double bill on a late Saturday night. Justin Kosh says, my grandma had this movie on VHS and would let me watch it every time I visited. She was my first supporter when it came to horror. She ruled. Let's see. Let me scroll down here. Get a few more here.
Tristan Comer says, my family has had this one on VHS for as long as I can remember. Never paid it much attention until a couple of years ago, and since then, it has become my favorite proto-slasher and one of my favorite movies ever. In addition, the gorgeous title sequence is tied with Halloween 2's opening as my favorite, and the soundtrack always gives me chills. It definitely gets two thumbs up from me. Scott Pliskin says, watched this for the first time last year on TCM. That's Turner Classic Movies for you guys over there. I don't know if you know about that, but anyway.
We got TCM over here.
Okay. Was surprised to see Sally Ann Golden from Friday the 13th pop up as a policewoman. Image may contain one person close up, and he posted an image, so I obviously can't show you the image. Louis Adams says, yet to watch, but remember the DVD at Best Buy in the early aughts. It's on Prime, so going to watch it before the next episode airs. Gareth Morgan says, I have this framed poster above my TV. And finally, Sean Gamble says, I've yet to see this. Is it worth a blind buy? And I'd say, yeah. I mean, it's a half great, a great film and a decent movie. So, yeah, it's worth a blind buy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Although, if he wanted to check it out first, I mean, like, you know, we were saying, it's in the public domain, so you could probably legally watch it for free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you to everyone who wrote in. We've got some other feedback, but before we do that, let's play.
Yes,
let's play how to get in contact with the show, and here are the contact details.
The content of this podcast was provided by Justin Kurzweil, Eric Frillfall, Nathan Johnson, and Joseph Henson. If you enjoy our program and are willing and able to provide a donation, please visit us on Patreon and become a content designated subscriber. That's patreon.com/thehysteriacontinues. For non-subscriber PayPal donations and general feedback, our address is the.hysteria.continues@gmail.com. To listen and interact, simply search for The Hysteria Continues on iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Susie versus Toya forever.
Yeah, so please get in contact with the show, and we've got some feedback. I've got a pussy trying to get in, so I'm just going to go and let him in. So who would like to go first? Okay.
I have one here. It's from Mark Lewis in Cardiff in Wales. And Mark says, hi, Justin, Eric, Nathan, and Joseph. Just wanted to drop a quick email to say how much I've loved the shows. I only recently came across you all. Oh, my God, lol, Eric, am I right? Yes, you are right. He came across us all. Just Joseph? No? No?
I told him, I said, give me everything you got, Shire.
He's having a great time listening at work. In particular, I've been working my way through your Friday the 13th reviews, and I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys think of the 2009 remake/reboot in October, although I have a pretty good idea based on passing comments and other shows. Now, I don't think we're... When is the next Friday the 13th? Is it October?
It's in October, but we'll be talking about Jason X.
Yeah, we have to get Jason X, and then possibly
We have to do Jason versus Freddy. Versus Jason.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a little while before we get to that one. So
anyway, about the Friday the 13th remake, he says, personally, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it either. It's just okay, but very definitely a missed opportunity. I think the film looks great, and Derek Mears instantly became my favorite Jason. He's certainly the best thing about the movie, but I didn't find it as fun as the older entries. Maybe it took itself too seriously in an effort to be a gritty remake. I hope they get another, quote, stab at it, but I'm not holding my breath. I also wondered what you guys thought of Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof. I love stunts, especially involving car chases and slasher movies, so I was expecting this to be my favorite movie of all time, a title currently held by Weird Science. Needless to say, it fell short, though it had some good moments in it, but I just wondered what you guys thought, and would you even consider it a slasher? Anyway, keep up this stellar work. I'll definitely be listening, and that's from Mark Lewis from Cardiff in Wales. So Death Proof, I think we've mentioned this before, I love Death Proof. I don't consider it a slasher movie in the slightest, and it certainly didn't deliver on the promise that Tarantino said in advance that it was going to be his version of a slasher movie. I do love it, though. I know it's very much a Marmite film for people. Some people think it's too slow. I just think it's just got great action, and it's got funny dialogue. Even the two-hour version I find zips by. I think, Justin, you're the polar opposite to me on this issue.
What, that I don't like it, or
I thought you don't like Death Proof. I thought, no,
I don't mind Death Proof. I was just disappointed it wasn't a slasher movie, and not even I certainly don't, I wasn't expecting Tarantino to make some kind of just a Friday 13th clone or something. But I thought he would take the slasher movie and do something kind of more interesting with it, rather than just turning it into you know, a car thing, which has obviously been done in with Duel and The Hearse and The Car and all others, lots of films before that. So I think, having said that, I mean, I when I watched Grindhouse, you know, with the other movie, was it, you know, I enjoy it, but it's, yeah, I just thought it was a bit of a given what he was saying about making a slasher movie. I thought he was going to put a Tarantino spin, like making like a basically a Kill Bill of the slasher movies, if that makes sense. But you know, turning something like
Bill, I agree with Eric. Yeah, sorry.
I was just gonna say, I agree with Eric. I love it. I think it's awesome. It's a really, really fun movie. It's not a slasher, though.
Yeah, it's not a slasher. Not even, well, no. Joseph is the one who shoehorns everything into slasher. So, Joseph, do you think it's a slasher movie?
No, not at all. But I do enjoy the film. I'm a big Kurt Russell aficionado. So anything with Kurt Russell, I tend to like. And I do like Death Proof.
Bill, are you a fan of Death Proof?
I love it. Yeah, it's one of my favorite films of his. And I don't think of it as a slasher either. But yeah, it's great, though.
I think it's one of his best as well, and it's like, apparently the majority of people think it's his worst, but hey-ho. Yeah. So that's...
I was going to say, my brother and I have gone to that restaurant where Stuntman Mike hangs out, because my brother lives in Austin, Texas, where they shot it. So it's actually, it's really tiny, if they make it look so much bigger in the movie.
Did you order those big, gloopy nachos?
I will go back and order them. I didn't think of it at the time. Yeah. I'm just excited to be there.
Okay, that's the feedback I have.
Okay.
Joseph, do you have any?
No, I just read off what I had on Facebook. Right. I gave all the feedback to you guys.
Okay. I have one.
Okay.
Yeah. This says, greetings, gentlemen. I hope you're all doing well. I thought maybe I'd write in and tell you that moving house recently has become far more tolerable, thanks to your witty banter and great coverage of films new and old. I particularly love the Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street episodes, as even though they're quite mainstream, I still find those as my pinnacle franchises. Speaking of which, could we possibly see a Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 episode on the horizon? It is, as we all know, superior in every way to the original. solely for featuring Dennis Hopper. Thank you for the many hours of glee. Cheers. Much love from your resident supervillain, the Hobgoblin. I didn't feel the love, Hobgoblin.
I think I would agree with Hobgoblin.
How dare you?
I think I prefer part two to part one.
No, 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 no.
You don't tell me what to think, girlfriend.
No, part one to me is obviously, well, I'm not going to get into it again. You guys know how I feel. It's the most perfect film in the world. That's all I can say about part one. I love part two, though. I'm not trying to say that part two is not a lot of fun. Part one to me is a much better film, but part two is just a really, it's a more fun film. So I'll give it that.
Okay. Ever the diplomat, Nathan.
Yeah. I didn't want to go full rhubarb on, you know, on the Hobgoblin.
Nobody
there.
Wants to see that. No.
I'm like, hey, you know, and I've seen Hobgoblins multiple times, and this is the thanks I get. You insult my favorite film. Well, not really insult, but goes. Still.
So you're a bit like Drew Barrymore in Firestar, so you're getting yeah. The color
like
on you.
Flaming Inga. Yeah.
Yes. He's the rhubarb starter.
I cook rhubarbs.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, well, I've got one here as well. So shall I go? Bill hasn't got, you haven't got one, have you, Bill?
I don't have one.
I'm not sure if Joseph gave you one, as it were.
Yes.
Oh, hey.
Gave him a big one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, here we go. Here's mine. It's, hey, guys, hope you're enjoying the summer so far. Just thought I'd drop you a line with a potential top three suggestion. I don't think it's one you've covered before, but it could create an interesting discussion. And I think actually there was a note from Joseph saying that I think we have covered this. But anyway, going on, he says, that is to let us know your top three favourite slasher horror movie posters or video covers. Admittedly, the podcast format doesn't lend itself to being able to show these covers in all their glory, but I'm sure you guys can make it work. The reason for my suggestion is following a sadness that descended upon me on my drive home from work the other night. I had the misfortune to see the very large billboard advertisement for the new Tom Cruise movie. Now, the Mummy, that is. Now, I can't say that I am a huge Cruise fan, but that being said, I expected something more from a movie that must have cost a few quid to make. But what do we get? A huge headshot of Cruise looking constipated and a massive pair of eyes. For the love of God, is there no imagination left? I know Hollywood likes to play it safe and have to be sure that their star is clearly visible, but there is nothing striking about the poster and definitely nothing that would encourage me to see it. Then again, a remake of an already dated remake. No thanks. Give me the original Universal or Hammer incarnations, please. They probably cost less to make than the cost of the crappy marketing on this new version. Don't ever even get me started on the Blunder Woman poster. I'd rather have a poster of Eric in a tankini.
What's a tankini? Well, I'm intrigued now.
Yeah, is that where you come?
I'm guessing it's a bikini that's tan in color, Eric.
Oh, maybe it is.
Do you have one of those in your bureau?
I may.
Or you have one that is kind of actually in the shape of a tank. Maybe. but he says it goes on saying, "Fat jokes, I have one somewhere."
Justin, really?
Yeah, I know.
What?
Shocking.
No, no, I meant that because but you could put your winkle through.
You're saying I'm built like a tank. Oh yeah,
but actually, you are. Yeah, you'd like that, don't you? It's not a fact, you know. I'm not saying, if I was saying like a space hopper or something, then that would be offensive, but I'm not. anyway.
You're so evil and mean to me.
Oh, Eric, you love it.
You're not allowed to play with my fidget spinner.
Okay, well, that's just as well. Anyway, he carries on, goes on to say, anyway, my top three slasher horror cover movie posters are Halloween, simple but effective. House Last on the Left. Sorry, Last House on the Left.
House Last on the Left.
Yes, well, it's an anagram. The original video cover was just black and white wording, but it fascinated and horrified me as a kid. Plus, I was never allowed to rent it by our video store owner. I was obsessed about seeing the movie. Then Dead and Buried, another one that fascinated me as a kid, and I still remember the original TV spot. I would love to hear about your favourites. That's from Tosca Top Socks, and it says adios for now. Oh. And Joseph's little note says that you should also mention that we did this in top three in episode 16, I think it was. But just a little recap, are there any slasher horror movie posters that resonate with you?
I think I went for Freddy's Revenge, the UK version, as one of my favourites.
Okay.
That's a good one. I remember talking about the House of Death with the body hanging upside down, and maybe I mentioned Headless Eyes. It's been, episode 16, that was 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I know that I mentioned Once Upon a Frightmare because that video box scared me when I was a kid. It had Sheila Keith with the drill on the front. Mm. So I remember talking about that one.
Mm. What about you, Bill? Any kind of your favorites?
I'm trying to think. I mean, I love the original painting for Friday the 13th. I mean, I know that's kind of an obvious one, but that's probably my favorite if I had to pick. Mm. I don't know if it counts as a slasher necessarily, but I always like the poster art for Dressed to Kill, the Brian De Palma film. Mm. Thought that was always really a nice one. But yeah, I'd have to really think about it.
Cool. Okay. No, there's a lot out there to choose from. I think I remember... mentioning the UK video art for Superstition, aka The Witch, which funnily enough tying it back to the Catholic thing with the bloodied hand with the cuts on it holding the rosary. That was kind of I remember seeing that at the video store and just thinking, and also Humongous, I think, was another one of the video cover for that with the eye looking through the peephole. So all the things that kind of made you want to rent something back when you were a kid, or probably would still do now, to be honest. But yes, well, thank you, Tosca. I don't think we've got anything else. Any other feedback, have we?
Yes, we do.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I have the game, and Nathan has something.
Yeah, my usual after the credits. And this is something actually that, you know, after the credits, we don't know what happened. So this will be fun.
Okay.
So my question is, what do you guys think happened after the end when all the mayhem in the church occurred? So I'll go with Bill first. How do you think the family went on after this?
I always thought that Alice was likely to start killing killing people herself. I mean, I always, you know, it's ambiguous, but that's how I always read it when I have watched it. You know, that she would go from, you know, strangling cats and just being a jerk to actually stabbing people.
What about you, Justin?
I would agree. I think she was probably jealous of the attention that the killer was getting, so she would think once she saw all the attention that the killer got, then she probably thought, actually, I want a piece of that. So yeah, I think she would have gone on her own little killing spree.
Do you agree, Eric?
Well, I think that's what happens after the credits is it's insinuated that she's going around doing the killing, but it's actually a paramedic called Roy doing it.
How old would Roy have been at this time?
I don't know, but like the end where she's looking a bit suspicious and glances at the camera was very Corey Feldman-ish. So it makes me think that Alice Sweet Alice Part 2 might be like A New Beginning.
Well, wasn't come on, Eric. Get your hands dirty.
Wasn't there supposed to be... there's still a remake, isn't there, on the cards by the Dante Thomas... I can't remember his name, but he's the...
Tomaselli.
Tomaselli. He's the nephew, isn't he, of Alfred Sol? And I think he's been trying to get the remake off the ground for a number of years now. It's going to be set in the 1970s. And I think the last I saw of it when I looked at it on Wikipedia was that they were still in talks trying to raise some money as late as last year. So I don't know if that's actually going to happen. But sorry, it's just a little aside. I forgot.
Joseph?
I'd say after all is said and done, the Catholic Church would try to deny culpability by offering hush money to a lot of the victims' families.
Controversial.
Very controversial opinion.
Yeah.
Well, I say that Alice was discovered with the knife. They realized she needed help. They got her the help she needed, and she grew up to be very happy and healthy, and the killing never happened again.
Aww.
Happy endings for all.
So positive.
Not very good idea.
I don't usually like movies that have unhappy finales. Unless it's very effective. It has to be very effective. Like Black Christmas.
But Nathan, this whole podcast is on slasher movies.
What?
You don't get many happy endings in a slasher movie.
Yeah, as long as somebody gets away, then I think it's a good ending. As long as somebody survives.
Mm. Okay.
You know. And there's only a few slasher movies I could think of where absolutely nobody survives. Mm. At least in the golden age of slashers.
Mm. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Nathan. So for that upbeat ending.
Yay.
Yeah. Joseph, what about the game?
We did have a correct guest last time. Mm. Oh. Justin, were you talking? Sorry.
No, I was going to say that Eric guessed it, didn't he, off air?
I did. I got it right.
Yeah, you did.
I got the Arrow release of Fish Called Wanda. I guessed that right as well. Yeah. I was right twice.
As far as players are concerned, Robert Ciardello correctly guessed Mortuary first.
I was expecting more applause.
I love that Joseph was just Eric was like patting himself on the back, and Joseph's like, okay, as far as players are actually concerned.
And I love the deafening silence. I want to congratulations all round.
If you're listening, Robert Ciardello, and I know you are because you're an active player in this game, I apologize for Eric's rude behavior.
Mm. We all apologize for it.
Mm. You're gonna get some anger.
Oh my god, there's one thing I forgot. You know who did not write in? Simon
Logan.
What's happened to Simon Logan?
I don't know.
I miss him. Yeah. Anyway, Robert Ciardello guessed Mortuary correctly first, so he gets a point. The new round is a new movie, obviously, and here are the clues. Number one, the tagline makes the grade. Number two, underneath the helmet. And number three, last film credit.
I know this one. Yay! Yeah, I finally guessed one right.
Yeah, you can tell me off air and see if you got it right.
Okay.
All right. Well, we're coming to an end of the podcast, so I just want to say an extra special thank you to Bill, not Eric, Bill, for coming on the show.
Good to have you on, Bill.
Thank you so much. I've heard every episode of your show like at least twice. I have all the commentaries you've done. This is total thrill for me to be on the show. So thank you.
It's been brilliant. Thank you for choosing such a good film. And can you remind people again where they can hear more of your work?
Yeah, yeah. So you can find my show at www.nowplayingnetwork.net/supportingcharacters. It's also on iTunes and Stitcher. I did want to also mention that there's a show that I've been on before called Tracks of the Damned that does audio commentaries for horror movies. I did one on Messiah of Evil, and I'm actually going to be on the Alice Sweet Alice episode they're doing at the end of the summer.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
That might be of interest to some of your listeners. They did like Friday 13th and the Scream films and like Mungo, but it's like fan commentary stuff. It might be of interest to some of your listeners, but yeah.
Ooh, did they do Scream from the 80s, the 1981?
Not yet, unfortunately, but they did all four of the Wes Craven films.
Oh, okay.
What's it called again, Bill? Sorry?
It's called Tracks of the Damned.
Tracks of the Damned, thank you.
Yep.
Isn't that a Toyer album?
Whatevs.
Never misses a...
Whatevs.
Never misses an opportunity.
No. Eric.
Of course.
Eric,
yeah.
It's your choice next, so are you picking?
Yes, I'm just going to remind myself who picked this one, I think. Yes, it's Justin Kosh's pick, and we're going to be covering the Giallo, All the Colors of the Dark.
Yes, which is just come out on Blu-ray, hasn't it, from Shameless?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or is it out?
Great.
Yeah. One of my friends did the commentary on that Shameless release. Sam Deegan does the commentary on that. I just got it myself. Yeah.
Okay. Oh. Is it good print?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, if you're a fan of that film, it's the best release of it by far.
Thanks. Okay, because I've only got an old German DVD, which is non-anamorphic, and it's a bit... Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'll definitely have to pick that up. So, yes, we'll be recording that in a couple of weeks' time. Again, thank you very much to Bill for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure, and hopefully it won't be the last time you're on. But we've still got about a gazillion listener picks to get through. So if you have pledged, then we will be getting to you eventually. It may not be this century, but we will get to you. Well, thank you ever so much, Bill, and thank you for listening. And I think we're going to play out with... I did try and see if there's any Susie and the Banshees related.
No, Toya might have a song that suits us better.
Well, if you can find one, let me know.
Well, she is a holy terror, so...
She is. But otherwise, we're playing out with some of the music from the show. So, yeah, join us next time for venture back into the Giallo. So say goodbye to the good people.
Goodbye, good people.
Goodbye.
Bye.
I am so sorry, Rhubarb Lady.
I wanted to go rhubarb, but I couldn't really go rhubarb on that because it wasn't your fault. But I did go rhubarb on Justin for forgetting me.
Fidget spinners are awesome.
What's a top? Why is it so popular?
Tops are popular. Lazy Susie and her lazy banshees.
It's a turnstile. A turnstile.
So Eric's going to have to listen back now because I made a little song for him and his love, Alfonso. We may get caught between the moon and New York City.
Alice pressed against the wall so she can see.
I did not buy that he would be a fan of Alfonso. I mean, the man has like 50,000 cats and he pees his pants and doesn't seem to care.
Alice in her party dress, she thanks you kindly. So serene, she needs you like she needs a trance to tell her that the world is crazy.
I'm in love with Alfonso.